Let me look at you just a minute. It's been 30 years since I stood regularly in this pulpit, and some of you sitting in the same seat you were in then. You're gray-headed and you're older, and that's all right. So am I. It's wonderful to be back. There aren't any words to describe what I feel for this church. There's no way to try. I won't even give it an attempt. But you mean a lot to me. The 8 years we spent here were probably the high watermark of my life. In fact, I think I blew a fuse while I was here. I think the four times every Sunday for 8 years got me. But before I came, before we moved here, I brought one of those serendipities that you talked about this morning. And you've heard it so many times you could quote it, but it changed my life and it affected my whole ministry. I have found in the Gospels the power to do what's in the letters. That was taught me by a young New Zealand girl. And it shaped my whole life from that point on. It shaped my entire ministry. And I brought it here with me at that point in 1972. And it shaped the sermons that came out of this pulpit. I have found in the Gospels the power to do what's in the letters. That was a profound statement. A serendipity laid on me by a young girl that was not more than 4 months old as a Christian. And then you allowed me 8 years to stand here and explore the Word of God with you and to discover more serendipities and to lower our blade and to enjoy the richness of the Word of God. And I'll never get over the time that you allowed me to be here, like you're allowing Noel to grow, to lift up the Lord. And I love that little guy, that little whiskered fellow, he's worse than me on names. He can't even remember his wife's name. He called her the blonde one. I'm not that bad yet. But I'm thankful for the way that you love him and thankful for him when he stands and lifts up the Lord for us to see and to love. We left here in June of 80, and went to College Station, Texas. And I discovered more serendipities there. And I want to share one of those with you tonight. Let me give you the background before I tell you what happened there in Texas. I was invited, after we got there, I was invited to the University of Texas to speak at a student rally. And I guess there were 200 or 300 students there at the University of Texas. And they assigned me a text to speak from. And I worked on it for weeks and weeks. And I just simply gave it all I had. But the sad part about it was I never could get a handle on it, even after all those weeks. The text they assigned me was, I want you to turn in your Bibles to it, to 1 Peter. 1 Peter chapter 4, verses 1 and 2. Therefore, since Christ suffered in his body, arm yourselves also with the same attitude, because he who has suffered in his body is done with sin. As a result, he does not live the rest of his earthly life for human evil desires, but rather for the will of God. And that's the text that they assigned me. For years, I missed that text. I didn't know what it meant. In fact, I just looked over it. I missed it, I think, for one reason. I had a skewed vision of what suffering was. I had in mind the rack and the slash and the knives and all that, and the lines, all that grody suffering that those people did. That's what I thought he was talking about. And that's probably much of what he's talking about. But it's much more than that. And then I had a false concept of what desire or lust or what he calls here evil human passions. I think I had a too narrow a view of it. I was talking about those grody ones. I thought, you know, of lust and hate and all of those things. Well, there are a lot of other emotions. There are a lot of other passions other than the dark, dark ones. There's jealousy. There's covetousness. There's all of those things that we call maybe the grayer kinds of passions. And I had missed all of that because I misunderstood suffering. I misunderstood passions. But the sad part about it was that 10 minutes before I was supposed to speak, I still didn't understand what to say. I just had missed it entirely. Well, the time came, the people, some 200 of them or more, assembled in this hall, and I was sitting down on this side, and I panicked. I mean, literally, I lost it. I got up and ran out. It was about 10 minutes till time for me to speak, and I got up and ran out. I ran down the hall looking frantically for an empty classroom. Then I found one. I went in and slammed the door, and I said, "Help!" I just shouted, "Help! I've got to have some help!" And I said, and I was kind of rude. I never have been rude with God before, but I said, "Look, I don't mean tomorrow. I mean right now." And I just yelled at him. Well, don't you know? If I hadn't believed in James 1:5 before, I believe in it now. If anybody lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, and he'll give it to him without reproaching him. Well, 5 minutes later, after going in the room, I went out knowing exactly what I was supposed to say. Now, I don't know whether you believe in answered prayer. I think you do. Do you believe in 5-minute answered prayer? After that, I never doubted James 1:5. I depended on it before, but I just didn't know that he would do instant prayer answering. But he gave me an answer there to a prayer, and I came out of the room knowing what I had to do. I knew I had to follow Jesus' example of teaching. Now, I didn't know that at the time, that that's what I was doing. But that's what I did. I came out of that class, stood up before that group of people, and did what Jesus seemed to have most of the time done. He came in through the back door. Jesus had a few front door experiences. He had a few audiences that gathered around him on a hillside, and he would preach to them. And he had this sermon that he maybe preached more than once, this Sermon on the Mount. He had a few like that, but not many. Most of his teaching came what you'd call going through the back door. They came in parables. The parables that he taught, they were the bulk of his teaching ministry. And sometimes it says without a parable, he didn't teach them anything. And so what I did, by the grace of God, was to stand up and come through the back door. I realized I needed to attack this text from the last up to the first. Christ having suffered in the flesh, and then from that point down to the last verse. And there are four of these phrases in chapter 4, verses 1 and 2. Let's read it again. "Therefore, since Christ suffered in his body, arm yourselves also with the same attitude, because he who has suffered in his body is done with sin. As a result, he does not live the rest of his earthly life for human or evil human desires, but rather for the will of God." And I realized that I was to take that last phrase of the four and then just work my way up. Because many of Jesus' teachings were developed out of human dilemmas, human predicaments, human sins, human circumstances that were detrimental to the people that held these ideas and all that were involved in these sins. And here's this fourth one. Look at the fourth one. He says, as a result, he does not live the rest of his earthly life for evil human desires. Now that one phrase hits everybody in this audience, I think. It's where I have done in my past life about 90% of my effort and the energy has been expended trying to escape the gravitational pull of the flesh into the freedom of the children of God and to live according to the will of God. That's what I want. And I'll guarantee you, everybody in here, you can say pretty well, you know, you're right. That's the human predicament. It's my predicament. It's your predicament. It's a universal predicament of fallen humanity, trying to escape the gravitational pull of the flesh. And as long as we're in the body, I think that's what we'll do. Gradually, as we come nearer to Him, the other that will slough off. But it'll be a lifetime process. But that first one, wanting to no longer live by the desires of the flesh, but to live by the will of God. Brother Wood, isn't that what you want? Doesn't that describe us all? I think it does. Well, look at the next phrase, the one just above that. For he who has suffered in the body is done with sin. He who has suffered in the flesh, one translation says, is finished with sin. Do you believe that? You know, did you ever hit your thumb with a hammer? Oh, well, you suffered in the flesh. Did you cease from sin? You say, no, that's actually what caused me to sin. One time, this last summer we were here in 79, you allowed me to be gone for the summer, and we built a house out in the country. Thanks to Harold Hines. He came in after the announcement, waddling in. You know, he had two false hips and two false knees and a couple of shoulders, and he came in and said, well, I'm going to be with you till you get it under roof. He'll never know how much of an answer to prayer he was. I'd still be looking for a tree to tie a wall to if hadn't been for Harold Hines. But anyway, I was up on the roof putting down some decking. And if you ever try to put a nail in decking on a roof, you know how tricky it is. Well, I reared back and I hit the nail, but it was the wrong nail. It hit my thumb so hard, I think the blood just ran up in my arm in fear. And it finally came back down, and I tried it again. This time it didn't escape. It went all over that plywood. Just smashed it. Did I quit sinning? Well, I really never did start, but I think if I hadn't plugged the sin hole, I would have. I'd flick it in my mouth. So it's not just suffering in the body makes you quit sinning. That's not what it's talking about. Well, what is it? Well, let's look above it and find maybe it's some advice there. Look at the third phrase. Arm yourselves also with the same attitude. Oh, now he's getting to a word there that has a lot to do with our Christian living. And it's the word attitude. He who has suffered in the flesh with this attitude. All right, we're getting closer and closer. Look at the first one of these phrases. Therefore, since Christ suffered in the body, arm yourselves with the same attitude. Now let me paraphrase it or give an expanded translation of it. Since Christ has suffered in the flesh with a certain attitude towards suffering, arm yourselves with the same attitude. For he who has suffered in the flesh with the attitude that Christ had has ceased from sin, so as to spend the rest of your time in the flesh no longer by human passions, but by the will of God. Now, isn't that what that's saying? I don't think I'm doing any disservice to the Scripture by adding in that with this attitude, because he's calling us to this attitude that Jesus had. Anybody object to that? I don't think we can, because he's calling us to the attitude that Jesus had towards suffering. So if we translate it with this expanded translation, since Christ suffered in the flesh with a certain attitude towards suffering, arm yourselves with the same attitude towards suffering as Jesus had. For whoever has suffered in the flesh with the attitude Jesus had has ceased from sin. Now that, you know, I can get a hold of that. What he's calling us to is simply to follow Jesus Christ. Now in this, we find him saying some things that we don't quite get a handle on. But he's calling us to do this. He's telling us how to suffer without losing our joy. What would you give tonight if you could suffer in the flesh, whatever way it is, emotionally, physically, whatever may be your suffering and wherever you may be, what would you give tonight to be able to do that without losing your joy? That's what Jesus meant, I think, in that eighth beatitude. Blessed are those who are persecuted for doing right. How can you say blessed are those who are persecuted? Because if you suffer like Jesus suffered, then you can do that. Otherwise, you can't. But the question I want us to ask tonight is, how in the world did he do it? How did Jesus suffer in the flesh? This young man read tonight very capably in the second chapter of 1 Peter. And in it, it calls us to follow Jesus Christ. This is the general message of all of 1 Peter. In this 1 Peter letter, this word suffering occurs 20 times in 5 chapters. 20 times he mentions the subject of suffering. Specifically, chapter 4, verses 1 and 2, parallel chapter 2, verses 21 through 23. Turn back one page and look at this. But how is it to your credit if you receive a beating for doing wrong and endure it? That's verse 20. But if you suffer for doing good and you endure it, this is commendable before God. For to this you were called, because Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps. Well, now that's the same thing that he said in 4:1. He said, have the same attitude that Christ has. Here he says, walk in the same steps that Christ walked in. He left you an example that you should follow in his steps. And then he goes ahead and talks about it. He committed no sin. No deceit was found in his mouth. When they hurled their insults at him, he did not retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. Instead, he trusted himself to him who judges justly. Now, that's the only thing that he says as to the how. It's not very specific. It's specific, but it's nebulous. He trusted himself to God. But how in the world did he, when he was insulted, how did he not insult back? You know the temptation. How, when they hurled insults at him, did he not hurl them back? How did he do it? Well, it's not all that easy. If you've tried it and succeeded, you're perhaps one in thousands. How do you act when someone mistreats you? How do you act when you get the short end of the stick? How do you act when people curse you? Well, he says here, when they did Christ that way, he didn't curse them back. He didn't hurl insult. He didn't retaliate. Well, I want to know how in the world he did it. And I think it goes back to his philosophy of life. Jesus had a certain philosophy of life that covered, I think, the whole of his life. And it's simply this, I will tell you up front. Jesus believed that you learn how to live only when you learn how to give. Now, God so loved that he gave. That's a basic principle. His son had the same philosophy. He was so filled with this same divine love that his entire life was that of giving. And so I'd like to just say the way that Jesus was able to suffer and not sin, the way he was able to overcome the threats and the intimidation and that all that was thrown at him, was that he had learned how to give. Now you may think, well, that's too simplified. Well, think about it for a moment. Turn back. I think we'll have to, if we're going to look at his philosophy, you're going to have to turn back to his life, and it's found in part of it in this Luke's account of the Sermon on the Mount. But in this is just part of it, But if you'll put everything that Jesus said in the context of his knowing how to give, I think you'll understand what I'm talking about. This was his philosophy of life by which he overcame the flesh. There are two kinds of giving mentioned here. There's the kind of giving that the world does. The world style of giving is in verse 34. Look at verse 34. If you lend to those from whom you expect repayment, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners expecting to receive, to be paid in full. If you do good to those who do good to you, that's the verse above it, verse 33. And if you do good to those who are good to you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners do that. Now that's the world's kind of giving. Define it for me. We call it, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. I'll scratch your back and then you scratch mine. We give expecting to be given back. And Jesus quotes that, and he says, well, that's no big deal. Even sinners do that. If you're just doing that, what are you doing more than others are doing? Now, that's the world's kind of giving. But you know what? That's the way we were raised. That's the way we were raised as children. Not intentionally. We did it. We were raised that way by example. And we're entering into a period of the year when giving is, well, it's there. And the way that you give, your method of giving will probably, you may rise above it this one day of the year. But you'll sink back down into your old habits of giving, expecting to receive. We give with what attached? How does the world give? We give with something attached. Strings. We give with strings attached. We give expecting to receive at least equal and maybe more than we gave. I remember as a boy going to a Christmas party, and my mother always went with me to teachers. She'd tie up little sachet bags of perfume. I was so embarrassed to take those things, bless my mother, but they would be tied up, you know, with a little bow, and I was to give it to her at the end of the year. Well, everybody else, I don't know what they were giving, but I was so embarrassed to give her that sachet. They call it, you know, it's kind of like that stuff you put around to keep away the, but it smelled better than that. But she took me down to the 10-cent store to buy this gift. Now, the limit was you can't spend more than $5. That was okay, pretty good bit then. Well, we found what Johnny, this boy, I drew his name. We were going to exchange. In fact, at Christmas time, what do? We exchange gifts. We exchange gifts. Well, what a wonderful Christian principle that is. Anyway, I got his name, he got mine, and I went to the store with my mother, and I saw what I thought Johnny wanted. It was this little car that had the motor inside it. You know, you do like that, and man, it would just take off. I said, oh, that's what he'd want. Yeah, that's what Johnny would want. Well, before he even hardly got back to the cash register, I already had it out of the box and was going like that with it, you know. That wasn't what Johnny wanted. That's what I wanted. My mother wore a thimble. She wore it on this finger. It was her punishment weapon. She was a precious lady. I remember one time she spanked me, just once in my entire growing up. I got thimbled often. We'd be sitting in church. Dad was up preaching. We were sitting with Mother. And if I was cutting up, here came that thimble, you know, and I got thimbled again, right on the noggin. And she just would do it, you know, just smiling, and she'd do that. Well, I got thimbled again about this car. I had it out of the box. Well, here she came with that thimble, and she said, that's not yours, that's Johnny's. Well, by the time we got home and had it all wrapped, I already hated him, and I didn't even know him. Well, the party started, and I had mine all wrapped up. It looked like a woman had wrapped it, and that woman had it. My mother had wrapped it, but here he came, and I was looking at his, see what he had in his hand. And what he had in his hand didn't look anything like what I had in mine. And I gave him his gift, and he gave me mine, and I tore into mine. His was this $4.95 car. I tore into the one he gave me. Guess what it was? It was a flat piece of cardboard with one little ball and about 10 jacks around it. He didn't even have the decency to take the tag off. I opened it or turned it around. 49 cents. You know what went through my mind? See if I ever give you anything else. Because I was looking at it like the world looks at it. I was expecting a $4.95 gift from him. Now look, we may not do that intentionally. We may not even know that we're doing it. We may not know that we're setting that example for our children. And we may overcome that gravitational pull on Christmas. But back during the rest of the year, the year before, in the coming year, if we're not careful, what we'll do is revert to that world kind of giving, where we expect something in return from our wives. We give a gift, we expect her to jump 2 feet off the ground, and she only kind of jumps maybe 2 inches. Well, we go around and we pout. Men are good. Oh, we're good at that. We're good at pouting. We're good at whenever we don't get what we feel like we ought to get in return for what we do, we pout. Women don't pout. They just get real quiet. Oh my. I told a young man tonight who was going to read and did read, I said, I want you to listen to what I say tonight, because what I'm going to tell you tonight, if I'd known this when I was your age, I would have been way, way down the road, way many years earlier. And it's simply this. Don't make your life dependent upon what others give back to you. Don't make your joy depend on that. If you and I make our joy depend upon the response of the people to whom we give something, then you're always going to be sad and disappointed. Do you know what I'm talking about? You've done it enough. I've done it enough. I know that there's a temptation to give like the world gives, and that is to expect something in return. Now look at what Jesus said. Jesus' kind of giving is this. Jesus says in, look at verse 27 through 31. He says, "But I tell you who hear me, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who mistreat you. If someone strikes you on one cheek, turn to him the other also. If someone takes your cloak, do not stop him from taking your tunic. Give to everyone who asks you, and if anyone takes what belongs to you, do not demand it back." Then later on he says, "But love your enemies. Do good to them. Lend to them without expecting to get anything back." There were years when I would not read those. There were the same years I wouldn't read Luke 14, where he says you've got to give up everything you've got to be a disciple of mine. I would bypass those. If not literally, intellectually, I would bypass them. But you know what? This is the most profound instruction that you can find in the teachings of Christ. And that's learning how to give. We'll never learn how to live a joyful life until we learn how to give. Well, essentially what Jesus is saying is risk the danger of being hurt. And that's what he's saying when he says, if they smite you on one cheek, do what? Turn the other one. Our temptation is to say, oh, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Hurt me once, shame on you. Hurt me twice, shame on me. How many times do we protect ourselves from being hurt? Jesus is trying to tell us, don't erect those walls of protection to keep you from being hurt. Love is always a risk. Love is always a risk. And Jesus is saying to us here, don't try to avoid the risk of being hurt. And then he says just flat out, do to others as you would have them do to you. We know that intellectually. But that's what he's saying. Do to other people like you would like for them to do to you. When you see somebody that's hungry, what would you like to, if you were hungry, what would you like? Well, boy, you'd like for somebody to offer you something to eat. We were over in Ball Knob today, and there was a couple standing on the road hitchhiking. Some blessed soul stopped her truck, talked to this couple. We saw them put that suitcase in the truck and another suitcase in the truck. And she went off to do them, to take them wherever they were going. They were hitchhiking. Do unto others as you would like for them to do to you. And then give, expecting nothing in return. The word really is lend, but it's lend or give, expecting nothing in return. In other words, give without any strings attached. You know why? Because giving is good. Giving is good. Friday night, we saw this Blind Side. If you haven't seen that movie, go see it. It's unbelievably good. And it's this philosophy. They interviewed this couple, I was told. They interviewed them on one TV show to see if they were really genuine. Come to find out, they were. These people, but the man said, you know, it's hard at first to do that. But the more you do it, the more you begin to realize, hey, giving is more fun than receiving. And we've heard that somewhere. Didn't somebody say something like that? That it's more fun to give than to receive? Yeah. Jesus knew how to live. Jesus knew how to give. I haven't got maybe time to tell you a story, very brief. But down in College Station, there was a lady who, her life was just in a mess. She had attempted suicide 3 times. Her husband and herself, they were forever in a divorce fight. Or they were forever being threatened for divorce. And one was after the other, and the other was after the one. But she and her husband were just awful. The women who surrounded her were Christian women. And there were times when they told me that she would just get in the car and drive off. He wasn't there. She'd just drive off, leaving 3 or 4 children there on their own. And the Christian women had gotten to where they would just go over and get the children and feed them and dress them and put them to bed. She'd come home after 2 or 3 days. But she attempted suicide 3 times. They finally convinced her to come in and talk. She wasn't a Christian. But they said, come in and just talk. He'll listen. So she did. And boy, she brought in several bags of garbage. And she started unloading all that garbage. And I listened, I don't know, for probably an hour, just listening. Then I made the mistake of asking her about her husband. Well, I shouldn't have. She opened up a whole new bag of garbage, and she started bringing out all that she had not said before. And she talked about all of this. And I told her, I said, you know, I bet you give in a lot to that man, don't you? Oh, I shouldn't have asked. She said, give in. That's all I do. That's all I do is give in to him every day. All of my life, that's all I've done is give in to him. I looked her in the eye and I said, lady, let me tell you something. Don't you ever give in to him again, ever. Well, it so shocked her. She was a smart lady. She was smart enough to know that. She said, what are you talking about? I said, just what I told you. I said, don't you ever give in to him again. I said, you've got to quit giving in to him and start giving to him. Well, it's as though a light turned on in her brain. She gasped. She said, well, I've done that to my friends, but it never occurred to me to do it to my husband. She said, I think I'll go right now to his office and tell him. I thought, oh, Lord, he'll have a heart attack. He had never had anything like that happen to him. I said, you've got to quit giving in to him and start giving. Oh, there's such a difference. Giving in says you're a zero. Here you are again, wanting more money for more clothes. What happened to that dress you bought 4 years ago? Here you want another Here you want some? And so you find, well, all right, here, take it. And you give in. But you say to the person to whom you give in, as far as I'm concerned, you're a zero. I'll be so glad when you get off my back. I'll be so glad when you get out of my life. Get out of my face. Take this money and go. But when you give to them, you don't say you're a zero. You say you're my hero. And I want you to be in my life forever. This is what I'm giving you because I love you and I love to give. What a difference there is. Let me just say to all of us here, all of us older people could say to these younger people, oh, if I'd only known that when I was younger, if I'd only known that when I was a teenager, that you only learn how to live when you learn how to give. And kids, if you'll learn to simply give, as Jesus teaches us, you'll have life on a string. He knows what he's talking about. He knows how to live. He's learned how to give, and he's trying to tell us how to give. And if you'll follow his instructions, of course, the thing that we don't like about it, we know if you think really hard, it means you're going to have to die to yourself. It means we're going to have to die to ourselves. I don't like that. I never have liked that. But I had to decide whether I wanted to be a follower of Jesus or not. And I finally bit into it. I don't do it all yet. But I know what to do and I know how to live. And I've learned how to give. And I'm trying my dead best to give, expecting nothing in return. Just because giving is good. Because the Lord lived that way. And I don't want to lose my joy. And you can suffer unjustly, even, and not lose your joy if you just learn how to give. Laying our life down begins the Christian life. It's a changing of your mindset. It's deciding, I'm not going to live for me any longer. I'm going to live for him and for others. And if you can ever change that one orientation to where the center of the universe is not you, it's God. And it's your task to fall in love with him and follow him to death. And in our conversion experience, then we bury that old dead man. Baptism won't kill you. That's not where you die to sin. We die to sin at repentance. If you don't bring a dead man to bury, you're going contrary to everything that we do. And you don't bury people in life to kill them, do we? No. They die first and then you bury them. The same thing is true with the Christian. You make up your mind whether you're going to live or die, and you go, if you make it up, I'm going to die to sin. I want to live to Christ. Then they'll take that dead body of yours and bury it, and you'll be raised to walk a new life. That's really living, because you've learned what it really means to give. And God bless us. Thank you for this privilege. If you need to come and respond in any way, come while we stand and sing, and let's encourage each other.